Hi, welcome to Beauty at Work. We're in between seasons at the moment, so please check out this clip from one of our episodes. When it comes to science education, why should teachers care about beauty? Well, according to award-winning educator and public speaker Dr. Punya Mishra, the answer is because beauty can help nurture our sense of wonder, which is vital for the pursuit of science. And in this clip, he talks about what a more aesthetics-driven science education might look like. Check it out.
I mean, one of the things I don't think in teaching we talk often enough about is like how you craft your curriculum, how you think about the nature of the experience. That is completely an aesthetic domain, right? You can have all the pieces in place, but if those pieces don't add up, you don't really have in what Dewey would call an experience. And so good teaching is about creating those experiences. And those are, at some fundamental level, quite aesthetic in nature, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to talk a little bit more about your own writing on beauty and aesthetics in STEM. Before that, could you tell us then, I mean, in terms of these aesthetic experiences, what role has beauty or aesthetics played in your own education, in your own experience, in your own work?
I think, I mean, the reason I got interested in science in the first place when I was growing up in Mizoram in India and in Delhi was I remember this moment of watching David Attenborough's Life on Earth, and had been reading some Gould and some stuff. I must have been 8th, 9th, 10th grade, and just understanding in a visceral way evolution. And then I couldn't see the world around me without having that lens of evolution. Suddenly, everything around me made sense from that lens. It's like, wow, that butterfly. I mean, I remember the sitting in the garden with my mom, a bright butterfly would come and land on a flower, and it would always sit with its wings closed, but the dull ones would sit with their wings open. And my question was, is that because, like, evolutionarily, if you're open like this, you're more amenable to being caught because you're bright and shiny or whatever, right? So, I mean, the point is it's not even whether that's a valid question to ask, but it gave me a lens into seeing the world. My dissertation that I did my PhD on was on the periodic system of elements. And to me, I think we do a disservice to chemistry by calling it a periodic table because it sort of makes it being one rigid thing. If you look at chemists, they have created 400 or 500 different representations. There are spiral ones, three-dimensional ones, because it's a complicated system of elements and complex relationships, which we have sort of essentialized into this one table, which we know is wrong, as every representation has to be. And so it's those sort of this element of the visual, the aesthetic, that were very powerful to me early on. And I think they've been deeply motivating to me even today. And I think, like most of when we talk about science education, we talk about it in such instrumental terms. But you go talk to scientists, they're not doing it for the salary. They're not doing it. And, you know, of course, the money is important. Don't get me wrong. I mean, my dean shouldn't hear this, but, you know, all of that is important. But the reason we do it are always deeper than that. It is this, you know, an urge to understand, to get a lens on the world. Alison Gopnik has this wonderful article, which the title of which I think I wish I had thought of that, but it's called Explanation as Orgasm. And, you know, Oppenheimer has this great quote where he says, you know, sex is for reproduction, but that's not why we usually do it. And so Gopnik says that evolutionarily, as the species, we get a kick out of understanding things. And so that explanation, that understanding of seeing the world anew, I think is a very powerful thing. And that's a deeply emotional, aesthetic, personal thing. So I think that's really driven a lot of how I think about education and why I am sort of very critical of many instrumental arguments, you know, for why we should be doing science or STEM or whatever you want to call it. Because I think that these are among sort of the greatest creations of the human mind, that we, this little creature on this planet, I mean, if you look at those pictures from the James Webb telescope, or forget that, I mean, you take your macro on your phone and look at a flower. I mean, that's, you know, to not be moved by that is kind of weird. And that then in education, we don't talk about that is to me an indictment of how badly we are doing things. And again, I don't think this will necessarily move everybody. That's not the point. But I think that there is a group of students, there is a group of learners who, if we approach this way, will fall in love with the science, with the math, with the ideas. And I think that's always been very important and motivational to me personally.
Yeah. Have you encountered that? Have you encountered students who perhaps may have been put off by, you know, the kind of rote memorization that's usually associated with science, kind of lack of creativity, but then sort of encounter
some
aesthetic?
Well, I mean, the research on that is pretty clear, right? That we are not doing a good job by our students. You know, a common friend of ours, Mark Girard, I think his dissertation is one of my favorite dissertations of all time. And was one of the first committees I served on when I was at Michigan State. And he did this sort of paired comparison between sort of a very good instrumental teaching of science, you know, and somebody who was doing an aesthetic sort of approach to science. So he would, like, this teacher would take the kids out and they would lie down on the ground and would be like, there is an ocean of air. And this is the, I mean, so starting to see. And so there is some evidence to show that in those kinds of classrooms, kids were talking a lot more about science outside of the class. You know, I don't know how old your kids are, but my kids are older now. But the standard conversation after every day of school was, what happened in school today? The answer would be nothing.
Yeah. It's the same here.
Right. So that is so depressing. It's like, this is where your minds are supposed to be blown, right? Anecdotally, I used to have this project in Chicago Public Schools working with STEM educators there. And in order to bring this aesthetic element into teaching, we started this thing called the wow, or the world of wonder moment. And so I would share some of my own. So I had one which was like, we were cooking some lentils at home and I saw this weird soccer ball pattern. And I started investigating how that happened. And I'm flying back from Austin at a conference and I see these cloud trains, which are these straight rows of clouds. And those are sort of connected by how heat moves and, you know, so on. And it's like, how cool is that? That something that's happening in my kitchen, you know, is also happening at the level of, you know, like geology or, you know, at the planet or whatever. And we would ask teachers to come up with this and say, find out why, what is puzzling about this? And so they would start sharing stories. And you couldn't go online and find something. You'd have to find something. That I was driving the other day and I had this question: where does all the sewage from Chicago go? And then you start finding out that that sewage actually led to Chicago being have to be jackhammered up because it was flowing back. I mean, it's hilarious how many things you can learn if you bring the sense of wonder. Now, one of the teachers in my class, I remember the first day she came in and she talked about how happy she was to be in this program because she was working with these four children who were completely at risk of falling through because of violence in the community around or whatever. And I remember putting my head down and saying, this is way above our pay grade. Like, nothing we do in this classroom can fix that or address that. 2 months later, she takes the world of wonder and creates a wall of wonder in her classroom where students can start posting questions. And she talks about how one of these kids was like so thrilled that his question got selected and then everybody collectively did research on it. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like we are humans after all. These things move us, right? I mean, you know, you look at the night sky, you look at the Grand Canyon, these things move us. And yes, is it something that has to be inculcated and encouraged? Absolutely. The beauty of a mathematical proof is not accessible to everybody unless and until you have been inculcated enough. So you are part of the aesthetic growth and development is developing this inner gyroscope. I mean, that's where sort of mentorship comes in. That's where understanding the rules of the game come in. That's where understanding the boundaries of the discipline come in and the kinds of ideas. And, you know, and then that's when you start really getting it. But I think it can start very early with very simple things. I mean, I used to do this with my kids where trying to explain to them the idea of mathematical functions. And we would do it by my walking across the carpet at, you know, or my son and I walking, you know, oh, he's going twice as fast as me. That's X equals 2X. That's a way of accessing math, which is real. And that it opens up the world to you in ways. And I think that to me is the best part of the aesthetic experience, is this opening up of the world and this continuous sort of regeneration that it never ends, because you know, you scratch that itch and you're going to have another one. You got another.
It's inexhaustible.
Another
No, that's absolutely right. Yeah. Tell us about why teachers should care about beauty in science education. I mean, that's something you've written about, and what why is it important in particular to, for teachers?
I think I've addressed a couple of the points, but I think just to reiterate, I think science is an incredibly human activity. And there are many elements that go into that sort of aesthetic experience, right? So one is this curiosity, this questioning, this sense of awe, this sort of anticipation of understanding. I think that is how science or any kind of inquiry begins. If we start by giving students the answers, you know, which is what we do, right? We scaffold like, this is what Newton's first law is and whatever. It just becomes a set of rote things that you want to learn. There is none of that appreciative.
Yeah, if you don't have a question, the answer seems pointless, right? I mean, just without evoking a question,
Right, exactly. Right. So one of the things that one of our professors here does, she has sort of a curriculum that she has developed. And she's an astrophysicist who got really interested in teaching. But her approach is like, you give students, they have to come up with a question. They have to go to original sources to come up with, here's the best part, more questions. So she doesn't want them to answer them because there is no answers. You know, you ask a question, the chances are the research in the field still is figuring stuff out. And so you have to come back with three more questions. And that's how the curriculum goes. And I thought that was so amazing. The second piece to me is why this it's important for science educators or all educators is the process. There is an element of sort of detective storytelling, of working with and against nature or the world to figure it out. Like if you think of a really cool experiment, it actually cheats nature in some ways to reveal its secrets. And so that's exciting. I mean, that's solving puzzles and, you know, working together. And that's, I think that process is where you start inculcating some of the foundational ways of looking at the world that that discipline has. Like, I mean, there's a reason that the word discipline is used. Like, it's not in the military sense of discipline, but it is a discipline. It is a structured, again, it's open. People can question it, all of that. But at least in a given field, at a given moment, there are certain ways that we do things. And I think inculcating that is through that process. And then finally, if you get the answer, there is this, that's that explanation is orgasm bit, right? I mean, it's like, wow. And I mean, I remember reading Feynman when I was young, and there's this one diagram he has from Newton's textbook. And it's like the simplest geometry thing, but I couldn't understand it. I don't know why, my mind just blocked. And then suddenly I remember the sleeping at night and I woke up. Like lying in bed, and I just sat up like, shit, I get Kepler's laws. You know, and did I discover it? No. This guy had done it hundreds of years ago. But that moment was real to me, truthfully, right? So I think it's that, it's the sense of like, I know something about the world that is so cool. That I think is super powerful. And now you see what happens is that you end up back with more questions, you know? And so to me, in some ways, this model of aesthetic learning maps the scientific sort of method in some way, but I think has a lot of pedagogical potential because you're starting with curiosities, you're starting with, and then develop techniques to address that question. Like, what's a fair question in this, right? I mean, one of the things that I used to do with my teachers is like back up the envelope calculations. It's like, how much poop is generated by humans every day in cubic foot? How do you even start? Like, do you know the density of poop? No, we don't. Okay, can we make some ballpark guesses? It's a hilarious question, but you can go down some really interesting, weird math sidelines, but it's genuine in the sense you don't, but you have to make estimates and guesses. And so to me, that is why to be human is to be a scientist, is to be a writer, is to be a painter, you know, is to be an artist, a musician. And I think that if we don't include these, we are doing a disservice to our kids.
I think that's really really important to, yeah, to certainly, I mean, I've been trying to think, you know, it's just because, you know, I teach as well, and I was just with my department yesterday, and we were trying to think through some of the challenges that we're facing with students who, in whom it's very difficult to generate that sense of wonder, the sense of curiosity, and we're trying to think through, like, are there emotional obstacles to learning? Are there emotional prerequisites for learning, right? So what does it take to become curious? Because we typically think about, okay, here's what I want to, these are my goals for this course. This is what I want them to know at the end of the course. And then we sort of figure out a structure by which we will pace that dissemination of content. But we aren't really paying attention to the emotional journey and to the process of how questions emerge and what does it take to create those questions. So I think, yeah, I think what you're saying is really, really vital, you know, for us, I think, in science education and beyond.
Yeah, I think the thing here is that it's going to be different for each person. Like what worked for me wouldn't necessarily work for someone else, right? And so one of the things that I try to do in like these programs that I had, particularly with working teachers in the master's program, is multiple things. Because something's going to click for somebody, something's going to click for somebody else, right? And so the World of Wonder thing was 15 minutes in the morning. That's it. But for some people, it sparked a thing. And then others are like, oh, you could do a Wall of Wonder. Okay, I'm going to try this in my classroom. And they took it in a different direction. It's fine, right? But the fact that after a long time, each of them became a learner. Because we forced them to. We said, you have to come up with something. You have to look at the world around you and come up with a question and then investigate it and come and report what you learned. You know? And so it would be like super interesting, like the things that would emerge from things, like just that open-endedness, plus having 15 minutes, no more than that. In like the design class I teach, I share some examples of good and bad design from the world that I've taken pictures of over the years. Things like doors with user manuals saying push or pull. It's like, you know, well, who reads a user manual? A and B, why should a door have one? And I make them go and take pictures and share. And they will, to a person, talk about how their relationship to the built world suddenly changes once they put that design lens on. And they start seeing it everywhere. They start seeing it in parking lots. They start seeing it in websites and processes for completing menus. They see it in water faucets. The number of examples we get from bathrooms and kitchens is amazing.
Yeah.
You know, but that's the lens, right? I mean, that's a way of looking at the world as being built, and sometimes built well, sometimes built badly. And we just don't pay attention to it. So I think that's one of the biggest things of the aesthetic thing is this idea of attention and noticing. It gives you chances to notice and pay attention to things in the fullness of it. And, you know, Csikszentmihalyi talks about this distinction between perception and recognition. And I think that very often what we do in school, we force this idea of recognition. We label thing a chair. The moment you see it as a chair, you don't see it for its heft, its weight, its texture, the way it leans back when you sit on it, how it feels. It's now a chair. But the moment what a designer does is sees the chair for all of these, he perceives, doesn't recognize. He sort of withholds recognition or has techniques to withhold recognition. And I think a lot of time what we do in education is that our goals become, by the end of the semester, by the end of the year, my student should be able to do the following, which you think is shorthand for they should be able to recognize. But curiosity and openness in some way demands that we focus on perception. Right? So there's this tension here. You want those disciplinary lenses to understand the world. At the same time, you want to be open up for the world to push back on these lenses and push back on your thinking. And that's a fascinating tension educationally, right?
Is there a way in which you have to inhabit a discipline first before you can question it or before?
But I think it can be done in authentic ways, in small ways. Right. So, you know, I had this whole argument with one of my friends who's a mathematician, and he was pushing back against some of these discussions about like all math needs to be authentic and we are spending too much time on blah, blah, blah. And he says, oh, no, this is powerful. This is great, blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know something? I mean, it depends on how you define authentic. if you define authentic as being what, you know, balancing your checkbook and just leave it at that, then that's a problem. But if you want to be authentic to the lived experience of mathematicians, then the aesthetic has to come into the picture, right? And so I think it depends on how you talk about the like, what is it that historians care about or economists care about? There is an aesthetic element to that.
Beauty at Work is brought to you by Templeton Religion Trust. If you enjoyed this clip, go check out the full episode. And please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a review. It really helps get the word out about the show. Thanks, and see you next time.